Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Writer Bianca Murray was born in South Africa in 1976. It was a time when the country was still very much ruled under the apartheid laws that separated people of different skin colors. Her first novel, Hum If You Don't Know the Words, reflects that difficult time in her nation's history. Murray's newly released second novel, If You Want to Make God Laugh, takes place in post-apartheid South Africa, just as Nelson Mandela is elected president. And while that was a more hopeful time in the country, the political realities of the 1990s were not pretty. Whites and blacks were still very divided along socioeconomic and racial lines, and the AIDS crisis that was about to explode into an epidemic was being ignored by the government. Bianca Murray will be in Milwaukee on Friday for an appearance at Boswell Book Company. Before he left, Mitch Tyke spoke with her about her new novel.
When we last spoke, you were thinking that you were going to be writing a sequel, or you were writing a sequel to your first novel, Hum If You Don't Know the Words. The book that is coming out this summer does not quite feel like a sequel, but it also doesn't feel entirely unlike a sequel. What did you set out to write, and how does it compare to what you wrote?
Well, when I finished Hum If You Don't Know the Words, I actually did begin the sequel. And I got about halfway through it and then showed it to my publisher. And they liked it. But, you know, this genre doesn't lend itself really well to sequels. And for a book to get a following where enough readers are interested in a sequel, it pretty much needs to be a New York Times bestseller. And so, you know, they said, we like the story, but I'm afraid we can't publish it. And so, obviously, I was quite crushed. I put that story aside. But the characters of Robin and Beauty stayed with me, which is probably how they crept into the new novel. So even though the new novel is a completely standalone novel, once again, it's set in South Africa. This time, the historical backdrop is South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy. In 1994, it looks at Nelson Mandela's presidency, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as set up by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and then the onset of the AIDS pandemic in South Africa. So although the three women in the story, Zodwa, Ruth, and Delilah, are all completely separate characters, for the fans of Hum, they will see cameo appearances by Robin and Beauty in this book.
Well, and so we should talk a bit about what happens in the book without giving too many spoilers out. Like your previous book, we are privy to the worlds of multiple protagonists whose lives intersect. Tell us who Delilah and Ruth and Zodwa are and what they are each doing as the book opens.
Right. So the three protagonists in this book are once again women. I seem to somehow be drawn to female protagonists. Ruth is a wealthy socialite. She's this real narcissistic kind of personality who's got, her third marriage is ending. And she's got quite a few issues. She's got some financial issues. She's an ex-stripper who's actually based on a real stripper in South Africa. And Ruth has reached this sort of crossroads in her life, and she's returning to the family farm to kind of lick her wounds. Delilah is late 50s. She's an ex-nun. And when we meet Delilah, she's just received a letter that you know has had a huge effect on her, and she has to give up her aid work that she's doing in Zaire and rush back to South Africa to deal with whatever this letter is about. And Zodwa is a 17-year-old Zulu black woman who is living in desperate poverty in a South African squatter camp or informal settlement, and she is pregnant. And when we meet her, we just know that she does not want to be pregnant and that she's carefully guarding secrets that, you know, could jeopardize her life. And these three characters, their lives come together, and that is how the story unfolds.
Right. Each of these women has some real issues that they kind of keep hidden in their background, some much more recent than others. But in all three cases, it really informs who they are and how they go about their lives.
Definitely. You know, we as people, never mind, you know, characters, I mean, who we are today is so formed and so shaped by our life experiences. And trauma, more than anything, you know, sort of fires our resolute clay, as they say. I mean, it shapes us. And each of these women have had some kind of trauma in their lives, things that haven't gone the way they've wanted them to, things that they've had to work around and that they've had to incorporate into their psyche. And this for me is what makes people so interesting, and this for me is what makes characters so interesting. You know, when writers write, so many writers are plot-driven. They write plot-driven novels, and they know exactly where the story is going. For me, I love to see where my characters are going to take me and what they're going to reveal to me more than anything. And if I can see it coming where they're taking me, then I'm not interested in writing the story. So when I write, I set about trying to find out who my characters are and how they've been shaped and how this affects them going forward.
I know there were some experiences and some real people from your own childhood who really shaped and informed the first novel. How did your lived experience inform this latest novel?
Yeah, so in the early 2000s, I had someone who I was very close to pass away from HIV/AIDS-related complications, and I didn't know that she was HIV positive at the time. And it was quite devastating to think about how there was this huge stigma surrounding the disease in South Africa at that time, even now, but then it was obviously so much worse, that she hid it from people because she was ashamed of it. And so, you know, it was my relationship with her and what was going on in the country at the time, seeing so many of my countrymen dying from this disease that the government was pretty much in denial about. You know, the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, at one point was a complete AIDS denialist. He went on record saying that, a virus like HIV does not cause AIDS. And it led to, you know, hundreds of thousands of South Africans dying. And so when I saw this taking place in South Africa around me, I wanted to step in from my safe white neighborhood and see if there was anything that I could do to help. And so I started volunteering in Soweto, which is, you know, Africa's largest urban black settlement. And for 10 years, I volunteered with HIV/AIDS orphans and their caregivers, many of which who were grandmothers, anywhere from their 50s to their 80s, women who had lost all of their children and were now left in poverty to raise their grandchildren. And so this very much shaped this story because these women told me their stories over the 10 years I was there. And they shared so graciously and so generously with me their experiences. And I felt like that needed to go somewhere. And so that shaped so much of the story.
Well, and I think the thing that maybe we in North America don't necessarily appreciate, I mean, I think one of the most interesting aspects of this time in history, as someone who is old enough to remember it from afar, you know, this is when Nelson Mandela became president and everything started to change in terms of race. But I think maybe a lot of us here forget that, you know, at one level, this was a joyous time for so many people, but at the same time, it is also the beginning of this really horrible time of the AIDS epidemic.
Right. And you know, so much of apartheid, the laws of apartheid, helped make South Africa ripe for the AIDS pandemic because the apartheid government separated families. They made people give up their homes, their land, and move to Bantu homelands. And then they sort of said, well, if you want to earn an income, because your Bantu homeland can allow you to earn an income because the land isn't fertile enough, there's no employment opportunities. So if you want to earn an income as a black man, you need to leave your family behind and come to Johannesburg and work in the gold mines or work as a laborer. And so it systematically set about separating families, you know, black men to the gold mines, black women to work in white people's homes as maids. They would have to leave their own children behind to be raised by their mothers. And so if you tear apart families like this at the most fundamental level, of course, it's going to make it so, so ripe for this sexually transmitted virus to spread. And that's exactly what was happening in South Africa at that time. So, yes, Nelson Mandela had just become president, and yes, apartheid had ended. But, you know, the wounds of the past take so, so long to heal. And these families were still so fractured and are still so fractured. And, you know, you look at the patriarchy as well of South African society across all cultures. Women had very little say in terms of being able to insist that men use condoms or any kind of preventative measure to stop themselves from being infected. And it just was this perfect storm that came together that allowed the AIDS pandemic to flourish.
It's the 21st century. You now live in North America, and an entire generation has come along and grown to adulthood since the events that informed this book took place. As a fiction writer originally from South Africa, is there some hope that you have that, that books like yours keep that time and place vivid in the memory of your readers?
I think it's so important that it does. And you know, there are South African readers that I have that have lived this story, but in their own little safe white suburbs without venturing out, who feel like they know the story, but they know their own experience and their own story. And I didn't know the experiences of other people until I started speaking to them and until they started sharing them with me. And so, you know, for the South Africans who know the story, they're getting a completely different perspective, something else to think about. And for the rest of the world, you know, only a handful of people of my readers ever say to me, oh, we knew exactly what was happening in South Africa. We knew all about apartheid. People generally are oblivious to it because wherever they were, they had their own issues to be dealing with. And, you know, as we're seeing in the US now, we are doomed to keep repeating our own mistakes. We're doomed to keep repeating history until we say to people, this is what happened in the past and this is where it got us. And we need to, you know, take a stand and say to hear and no further. And we're not prepared to keep doing this. So I think stories like this are so important because even though it's kind of historical fiction, I think we still have so much to learn today.
How were you perceived as a white volunteer in Soweto working with AIDS patients? I mean, this is something that comes up in the book, and I'm curious how your own experience compares to the similar experience that you depict in the book.
Right. So my experience was amazing. I mean, the people of Soweto could not have been more gracious to me. They could not have been more welcoming and kind. And in hindsight, I don't know how much of that I deserved because, yes, certainly I was coming in with very good intentions to help these people. But I did come in with kind of a white savior complex. And this idea of myself that I could help save these people almost from themselves. And I don't know how gracious I would have been if the tables were turned and I was one of these people having some very privileged white woman come in and tell me how to live my life and how to fix my problems. But yeah, you know, it was heartwarming, kind of soul destroying work at the same time, because I've never had such a period of growth in my life in terms of life lessons and in terms of just coming out of it, you know, so much more informed and so much more empathetic. But at the same time, it was quite devastating to be a part of that. And I'm still close with many, many families that I worked with during that time. You know, you speak about how there's this whole generation who's lived through it. But before the South African government made antiretrovirals available to HIV-positive people, you know, there were children dying anywhere from birth to 2 years old. Most of them, that's as long as they would live, and it was devastating.
It is hard to read this novel without considering the Me Too movement of the present day. How did you approach taking on those kinds of themes while still living in the world of the mid to late 1990s when Me Too was really not yet a thing?
Yeah, I feel like Me Too has kind of always been a thing, but women had the shared experience, and that's at its core what Me Too is about. It's that, you know, a woman shares this experience and another woman says to her, I myself have been through this. I myself have experienced this. But at that point, women lacked the power or the voice to come out and really address it like they're doing today. This is a kind of a feminist book. It is kind of Me Too, but these women, the difference was what they were going through then and what women go through now. is that, you know, it didn't even occur to these women that they had recourse, that they could do something about their powerless situations. They just, you know, try to make the most of it. They took this trauma in and they try to just move on with their lives. You know, in the character of Delilah, without giving a lot away, you know, early trauma shapes her whole life. It shapes her approach to relationships. It shapes her feelings of worthiness. Is she worthy of love? Can she give love? Can she receive love? And it's only like almost in her 60s that she's finally able to come to grips with these issues that have defined her for so much of her life. And, you know, just because women then weren't speaking out about it doesn't mean it wasn't happening to them. And that, for me, was so important to explore.
There are a lot of sad things that happen in this novel. Is it at all weird to be joyful about the publication of a sad novel?
You know, it is a sad novel, but there's also these moments of levity in it, which I worked into my first novel as well. You know, there's moments that I've had early readers say they just laughed out loud at. And that for me is what life is so much about. You know, no life is without these dark moments and these deep kind of valleys and these challenges. But what, you know, how we deal with that, how we let it define us is to me so much more interesting than the hardship that we endure. And yeah, there's tough themes in it. There's a lot of, you know, dark stuff explored. But at the same time, each of these women come out of their ordeals in their own way, like a baptism of fire, stronger for it. And for me, there's so much hopefulness in that. It's, you know, that there's hope, no matter how bad things get for us, no matter how dark they get, no matter our adversity, that there is hope afterwards to keep carrying on. Well, and definitely joy to be found in, you know, in the novel's publication. Always, as a writer, to know your book is going to end out in the hands of you know, the readers who need these messages is so important to me.
Well, it is another moving and enjoyable novel that I feel like a better person for having read. Bianca Murray, thank you so much again.
Thank you, Mitch. Thank you. It's always wonderful speaking to you.
South African writer Bianca Murray's newest book is If You Want to Make God Laugh. She'll be at Boswell Book Company this Friday to talk about the novel. Murray spoke with Mitch Tyke.